This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Elizabeth Pearson, news editor of BBC Sky at Night magazine, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
And production editor Dave Golder.
Hi there.
In this episode, we'll take a look at what we've learnt putting together the January issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, looking at red moons, green stars and blue stragglers. Coming up later in the episode, we'll take a look forward to all the exciting space missions 2019 has to offer. We'll be interviewing Kerry Donaldson-Hannah about the OSIRIS-REx mission, which will spend 2019 and beyond studying the asteroid Bennu. So, Chris, would you like to get us started on what caught your eye in the January issue?
Yes, well, on my multiple readings of the January issue, before it went to press, one thing really jumped out at me was Chris Lintott's Cutting Edge, in which he looks at new science papers coming out. And the one that particularly caught my eye was about globular clusters and how many blue stars are in globular clusters. Now, blue stars are very bright, and they're the most energetic of stars, giving off, really, they're very hot, so they're massive stars. And because they're massive, they burn through their supply of fuel really quickly, so they don't last very long. And traditionally, globular clusters don't have many blue stars. And this science paper looks at how to tell the age of globular clusters through blue stars. And he did a couple of scenarios where he did some modelling, the scientist, and he came up with two scenarios for how blue stars would be made or produced in globular clusters, one of which was small red stars in binary two in a pair, mm-hmm. and they're orbiting each other and they come together and they merge. And then all of it, instantly, you have one big star. So it's like a kind of, quick way to make it. These two red stars become one big blue star. And the other way is a bit more exciting, and it's a core collapse of the globular cluster.
That does sound a bit more dramatic.
That's pretty good.
That's something science fiction writes.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So what happens here is that the stars in towards the centre of globular clusters, kind of get closer together, and then they merge directly. They kind of collide together. These aren't binary stars orbiting each other. They just collide together, and that produces the blue stars. And this can happen when globular clusters are billions of years old, as is the case with ones like M30 and M13. His modelling found that both processes were slightly more efficient than had been thought. He reckons there are more blue stars in these globular clusters to be observed.
So it's a case of we need to go hunting for them.
Yes, that's right. Ah. And you know, the interesting thing is, those of our listeners who have larger telescopes which are able to resolve single stars in globular clusters, that's a really interesting target and a new bit of science to go and to go and hunt down.
More citizen science.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's one of the always the big thing with sort of space science is quite often it's that question of, is it actually that these are the sort of populations of stars or whatever that we're seeing, or is it just that we can't see the other half?
Yes, they're kind of hiding behind the dust cloud.
Yeah, these are the ones that are there, or these are just the ones that we can see. It's always that big question.
Yeah.
It's quite a resource, though, isn't it? As a researcher, if you've come up, you make this model. Mm. This model tells you something which is counter to what was previously believed, and then you can just use the world of astronomers as your resource to go, well, should we try and prove this then?
Absolutely, it's really valuable. Yeah,
it's one I've heard a couple of astronomers saying, but it's really useful that there is such a strong amateur astronomy group out there, because a lot of the other scientists don't have that sort of resource to be able to sort of have all of these people that are engaged and enthusiastic and have the equipment.
Yeah. It's a bit frightening if genetic engineers could
it's increasingly happening, which is slightly worrying, but so at least amateur astronomy can't cause a global pandemic, so good. Anyway, David, what have you been learning about this month?
Well, we're going to go from blue stars to green stars now, because we've got a great feature on some stars that don't exist. But don't let that ruin your fun if you want to try and spot them, because you can indeed get your telescope out and try and see some green stars. The thing about them is that no star actually, or as we perceive them, because there's another way where you can say they do glow green, but as we perceive them with our human eyes, no star actually glows green. However, there are certain optical illusions that happen in the sky, normally with binary stars, that's kind of with the way they interact with each other. That means that some stars do indeed glow green or look green. Even I made the mistake there. They don't glow green, but they look green. We've got a great little feature which goes a little bit into the science, but it's more of an observing challenge to try and spot these green stars up there. But there is actually, as I worked out, a green star very much closer to home, because our own star is green. Chris knows a bit more about the science behind that, but it has something to do with you know when you're a kid and you have what they called spectrum wheels. Do you remember spectrum wheels? Like round sort of disc, and you have all the colours.
And then
you can turn them into a little spinning top thing.
Yeah.
And all the colours vanish.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
And it's the same kind of effect, isn't it, Chris? It's the fact that the sun is actually, it actually emits a lot of green radiation, but because there's so much of the other colours around it, they kind of merge into a white.
Mm. Yeah, because green is in the middle of the spectrum. Mm. So if a star is giving off most of its light in the green wavelengths, and it's also giving off a lot of light in the other colours just around that.
Yeah.
So that means yellow and kind of red and towards the blue end as well.
Yeah.
And so what you get is like the spinning colour wheel, which is a mixture of all of them. And to our eyes, that appears as white.
Yeah. Mm.
It's one of the reasons why they think. Well, why some people think that plants are green, because there's two types of things that do the job that chlorophyll does. Mm. And one of them's red and one of them's green. Mm. And because our sun puts out more green light, that's why we went kind of towards the green one. I was reading something the other day that was saying, now I'm straying into biology here, but that is I think it was our sun used to be redder in the past. Mm. And people think at that sort of time there was more of the red one that was around. And then as the sun got greener, we went towards the green end.
Yeah.
And but of course, there is an occasion where we can see the sun actually glow green. Very, very if you're lucky and you're near the sea normally, there's an effect called the green flash, which happens at sunrise and sunset, just as the sun's on the horizon.
Yeah.
And it does actually momentarily become a kind of like long elongated green flash. And apparently, I was actually lucky enough to see that once. It was genuinely
a day after
somebody told me about it. We went, we're down by the Pembrokeshire coast, let's go down and look at it. And amazingly, we saw that happen.
Cool.
What I haven't seen, and I read about this morning, is apparently occasionally he actually shoots up like a beam of light.
Like a column kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I've heard that, but apparently that's very rare.
Yeah,
people see that. You need to have like other perfect conditions for that to happen.
Yeah.
And you were saying that the moon can sometimes even.
Yes.
Do a green flash.
So this is actually looking forward to February's issue, but apparently yes, because the moon is basically just the sun's light reflected off the surface of the moon. So it has a lot of, as it's rising and it's setting, it has a lot of the same effects that the sun has as it's rising and setting. So you can sometimes get a green flash off the moon.
And that basically, because we didn't go to the science of it, is again, it's that old thing, it always is. It's the Earth's atmosphere. It splits the spectrum. The spectrum we were talking about earlier, all merging into white. At that point, when it's the sun's so low on the horizon, there's an effect where the Earth's atmosphere splits the colours out again, and briefly we get to see the green.
Cool. Yes. Very interesting.
So on to me. This month I've been reading, looking ahead towards 2019, so next year, and seeing what we've got to look forward to in the next year. And in terms of space exploration and spaceflight, it's going to be a bit of a bumper year. We've got quite a few things going on. It starts off in very, very early in 2019. Mm. In fact, on the 1st of January 2019, we have quite a big milestone, which is New Horizons is going to be flying by Ultima Thule, which is its second target on its journey. So that's, I'm quite really excited to hear about that. It'd be nice to sort of wake up on New Year's morning and read about some space.
We're going to get some actual images of this.
New Horizons.
Body.
When we flew by Pluto, when it flew by Pluto, we got pictures back within a couple of days. I mean, it took 16 months for it to, or something to get, because it's so far away.
Yeah.
Its bandwidth is so low, it takes ages to get everything back. But hopefully, we should see like the first couple of pictures. Even on the days as it approaches, we'll
That's
be able
incredible.
To get something. So, yeah. But
it's the fastest moving. New Horizons is one of the fastest moving spacecraft, isn't it?
It was until the Parker Solar Probe launched. I think it was the Parker Solar, because smashed the record like three times over. But it was until like earlier this year.
Yeah.
It was the fastest probe ever launched.
Its actual time, the actual flyby is going to be over just like that.
Oh, it's really short. It's amazing how much they get from such a short time. But they've already rehearsed it once.
Yeah.
to make sure that everything's working and they know what they're doing.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so rehearsed in like the summer sometime, apparently.
What a start to the year. What's coming later in the year?
Later in the year, we've got the gravitational waves experiment LIGO. We'll keep on doing its thing. And it's also going to increase something called open public alerts, which are members of the public can, well, it's mainly meant for members of the scientific community, but observers at home as well can sign up to get alerts of if they think they found a gravitational wave, so that you can point your telescope and try and see if you can see anything. So that's like another citizen science that you can possibly get involved with. There's also hopefully we'll see the first test flights from the Commercial Crew Program over in the US.
Wow.
Which is the first attempt to get US crewed launches, human launches, since the shuttle went in 2011, I think that was.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime.
You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
That's exciting, isn't it? And interestingly, that has just, because we're recording this just the day after Virgin Galactic managed to do a reach the edge of space. They reached to get they managed to get 50 miles altitude,
which, about 80 kilometers.
Yeah, which is classed as the edge of space in Spaceship Two, and that so they've done that now. They've done the first manned space flights from US soil since the shuttle was the last shuttle flight. 2011. Yeah. But yeah, exciting. More of that. Really good.
We're also going to have a lot more missions that are going to be investigating things up close and personal. So we've got Chang'e 4, which is the Chinese spacecraft, which launched a couple of days ago as we were recording this. It is going to be the first mission to attempt to land on the... Not to attempt, but to land, if it makes it successful, to land on the far side of the moon. I just remembered some Russians tried in the 60s. Yeah. Yes, it's hopefully going to touch down on the far side of the moon. So hopefully we'll be getting back from there soon.
Is that just for bragging rights, or are they actually got a good scientific reason for it?
It's partly for bragging rights, but also we've never been to the far... We know the near side of the moon very well, but the far side of the moon, they do actually look quite different. If you look at the pictures of the we all know what the near side of the moon looks like because we see it, you know, every month. But it's got these, like, huge mare and things. On the far side of the moon, they don't really have that. It's a lot more crater, like, individual small craters, and it's a lot more pockmarked. And quite often, if you look at, like, pictures of Mercury and pictures of the moon, far side of the moon, they look quite the same. So it's sort of finding out what those two differences is and see if there's any kind of, you know, actual mineralogical differences. There's also two missions that are currently ongoing, which is Hayabusa 2 and OSIRIS-REx, which are currently at two separate asteroids, investigating those and having a look up nice and close at those two.
Brilliant.
Hayabusa 2 earlier this year put down the first ever rovers to get onto the surface of an asteroid.
Are they the hopping ones?
Yes, they were. Well, wow. I say the rovers. They roved by hopping. And more hopped, the one that did. But the thing that's really exciting about both those missions is they're both planning on bringing samples back to Earth, which is we haven't had many sample return missions, and most of them involved a person. On the moon missions. So that'll be really cool.
That's exciting.
To learn more about OSIRIS-REx, our staff writer Ian Todd talked to Kerry Donaldson-Hannah about the mission.
So today I'm talking to Dr. Kerry Donaldson-Hannah from the University of Oxford, who is a scientist working on the OSIRIS-REx mission. Dr. Donaldson-Hannah, thanks very much for speaking to me today.
Oh, thanks for chatting with me at such an exciting time in the mission.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's worth at the start, though, kind of going over the kind of main points of the mission. So why do we want to study asteroids?
Yeah, so asteroids are really scientifically compelling for a range of reasons. The first is by looking at asteroids through telescopes and spacecraft and also studying meteorites, which we think are chunks of asteroids. We see that these small bodies are likely the building blocks of other terrestrial planets. And so that's what formed the Earth and Mars and Venus and likely Mercury. And so understanding these small bodies then tells us something about how our own Earth formed. And they also seem to contain the building blocks of life. And so when we look at carbonaceous asteroids like Bennu, which is the target asteroid for OSIRIS-REx, and also Ryugu, which is the target asteroid for Hayabusa 2, we see volatiles, we see organics, we see amino acids, we see all the fundamental components of life. And so these bodies are suspected to have brought those components to Earth and filled, started life in Earth's oceans. So fundamentally, they're just the building blocks of the planets and likely life. Second, asteroids can also potentially give us resources for exploring the solar system further and further out. Currently, the way we explore the solar system is by launching everything onto a single rocket into space. Everything has to be launched from Earth, which makes it quite expensive. But if we want to start sending humans to other planets and exploring further into the solar system, we need to be able to get resources in space. And asteroids likely have water and other resources that might be able to be used for those resources. And then last, there's a select group of asteroids that at some point could potentially come close to Earth or could potentially impact Earth. And so studying these bodies and understanding their physical characteristics and their chemical makeup gives us an idea how we might stop that from happening or mitigate those impacts.
Okay. Why was Bennu chosen? What's special about it? And also, now that the spacecraft is there, what sort of science can the spacecraft actually do?
Yeah, so they kind of established a set of criteria for picking asteroids. And the first was, one, they just wanted an asteroid that was close by because that would be easiest and quickest. And so they were looking at near-Earth objects, which are asteroids that are basically orbiting the sun at the same distance that Earth is, so approximately one astronomical unit. And they were looking for an asteroid that had a similar orbit shape, so something fairly circular like Earth's orbit, and then also something that its inclination was fairly low. And what I mean by that is that the angle of its orbit is not too high off of the solar system plane. And so I think out of 7,000 near-Earth objects, just using that criteria reduced it down to 192 asteroids. And so then they wanted to look at an asteroid that was of the appropriate size. And so, looking at the orbital dynamics or the spin of asteroids, you can see that anything that's less than 200 meters in diameter spins so fast that material can actually be ejected off of it, which would make it really difficult for sampling or for the spacecraft to engage with the asteroid. And so they looked for asteroids that were larger than 200 meters in diameter. And so that reduced the candidate pool from 192 to 26 asteroids. And then finally, they wanted to go to an asteroid that was very carbonaceous in composition, because like I said, we want to study, where the origin of life, so things like volatiles and organics and amino acids might originate from. So they wanted to find a body that would likely have those materials. And so specifically using telescopic spectra of different objects, as well as using laboratory spectra of meteorites, they were able to identify and down-select 26 asteroids down to 5. And then they finally settled on Bennu.
Okay. And now that the spacecraft is there, can we kind of draw parallels with perhaps the Rosetta mission to study Comet 67P? Is it like that? Is there a lander? I mean, what sort of science is actually going on?
Yeah, so the spacecraft actually has a whole suite of instruments similar to Rosetta in the context that there are cameras. So we'll be mapping the surface at a whole range of spatial resolutions from the different cameras on board, similar to what we saw with Rosetta. There'll also be spectrometers on board. One spectrometer will be looking at the light that is reflected from the surface at visible to infrared wavelengths. And I believe that Rosetta had a similar instrument on board. We'll also be looking at the heat that is being emitted using a different spectrometer. And so we'll be looking at the thermal emission. That I think is different from Rosetta. And so those two things will tell us like what the surface looks like geologically speaking, and then it'll also allow us to map the composition, identify different minerals and materials on the surface. And so those two things were definitely done with Rosetta. Also on board is a laser altimeter, which will allow us to map the topography and really know the surface structure, which will be really important for sampling the asteroid. There is not a lander on OSIRIS-REx, so we are not going to have a little fillet that goes down to the surface and does experiments at the surface. Instead, what OSIRIS-REx has is what they call the touch-and-go sampling mechanism. And it's basically this long arm that almost looks like it has a vacuum head at the end. And the spacecraft will just slowly go to the surface and touch the surface for like 5 seconds. And during that 5 seconds, nitrogen gas will be burst into the uppermost surface. And that will act as a vacuum to pull material into the sample head. And so that's how we'll be sampling the surface. It will just be touching it for just a few seconds rather than sending a lander or trying to, you know, I think on Rosetta they had the harpoons or the, you know, the grapples that tried to keep fillet or that they tried to land with.
I would just also be interested to kind of know how you came to work on the mission, because whenever we kind of have these big international, you know, NASA and all the other space agencies missions, it's always very interesting to hear that there are scientists based in Britain working on them. So I was wondering, like, if you could say how you came involved in the mission, and are there many other kind of British institutions working on the mission?
Yeah, so I was actually finishing up my PhD at Brown University and was mostly focusing on the moon, doing research. And I started looking for a postdoctoral research fellowship. And someone that I knew from the moon mission that I was working on called Diviner, they invited me to apply for a position at Oxford, and specifically to start doing experiments for OSIRIS-REx. And so I thought that sounded pretty interesting and a good way to kind of expand my research interests. And so I took the postdoc here at Oxford. And so I've been here for about 5 years now. And initially, I was just working as a collaborator on the mission through my postdoc advisor, Neil Bowles, who's a co-I on the mission. And so I started making lab measurements and building up spectral measurements of materials that we think are going to be on Bennu, which will help when we start getting measurements of the surface, help interpret that data. And then I guess it was a year and a half ago, NASA opened up a call asking for scientists to apply to be a participating scientist and kind of having your own independent research project on the mission. And so I applied along with, I think there were maybe 70 to 80 other applications that went in. And I was selected as one of 13 participating scientists to be on the mission. So I kind of transitioned from being a collaborator working under my postdoc advisor to now kind of being my own independent scientist on the mission. Myself and Neil Bowles here at Oxford work on the mission. We're mostly interested in trying to understand surface composition and the thermophysical properties by looking at the spectra that we're going to get back from the spacecraft. But definitely there's others involved on the mission. At Open University, there's Ben Rosetas, who's going to be really heavily involved in using thermal models to understand the properties of the surface and also understand how the orbit and the rotation of the asteroid is evolving over time. And we also have Ian Franke at Open University, and Ian is going to be doing a lot of sample analyses once the sample is returned. And so Ian will be using laboratory facilities at Open University to study the isotopic composition of the sample. And then there's also Sarah Russell and Ashley King at the Natural History Museum, who also will be involved more after the sample returns. And they're hoping to also do laboratory analyses at the Natural History Museum of the sample when it returns. So there's a, you know, there's a whole range of UK scientists that are involved kind of with all aspects. You know, we're, Neil and I are focusing on understanding remote sensing and trying to help pick a sampling site. Ben Resitas is trying to understand how to also help pick a sampling site and keep the spacecraft safe while we're in orbit. And then you have Ian, Sarah, and Ashley, who will be focusing on studying the sample once it gets back and putting it into the context of other samples that we have from meteorites and other missions.
Yeah, that's like probably the most exciting thing about the mission, isn't it? The fact that we're actually going to be able to bring samples back to Earth and study them. I mean, that kind of thing's not been done before in an asteroid, has it?
No, so, you know, I was hearing Dante Loretta give a talk at, who's the PI of the mission, at the American Geophysical Union meeting, and it kind of reminded me that no other spacecraft has ever brought back this amount of sample before. So it'll be the largest sample collection since the Apollo astronauts flew to the moon and hand-collected sample at the lunar surface. So that's pretty exciting and pretty amazing.
Yeah, but we are already getting some results back from the mission, aren't we? I mean, I think it was in the last week, there's the announcement of the discovery of water. I mean, how exciting was that?
Yeah, I mean, so when they were picking asteroids, they were certainly doing a whole host of Earth-based telescopic observations. And so we thought we knew what the shape was from looking at radar data. We thought we knew what the surface was going to be like how big the boulders were going to be and how big the particles of the soil would be. And then we also thought we knew the surface composition. And so these first results have shown that they were pretty spot on with radar observations in understanding the shape of the asteroid. And so while we have better shape models now that we're engaging with the asteroid, it showed that was pretty spot on. We also, before we got to Bennu, thought that the asteroid should include hydrated minerals, or so minerals that at some point in time have interacted with water. And sure enough, the spectra that came back during the approach phase has shown that, in fact, we do see across the surface minerals that are hydrated. And so there is water in their crystal structure. And so, yeah, so those are, even though we kind of thought we knew these things, it's still exciting to see it. And then I think one of the more interesting things is one thing that we were surprised by is how many boulders are actually on the asteroid. So that wasn't anticipated. Like, there was anticipation there would be some boulders, but we certainly are seeing a lot more boulders than we anticipated. And so that'll definitely make it interesting and challenging over the next few months as we're trying to investigate where we might want to sample.
Mm. And does the discovery of water have any implications for our understanding of how water arrives in our planet? Is it that kind of field?
Yes. So what we can see is that, you know, so there's some type of probably clay material on the surface. Now, clearly, the asteroid itself is quite small, and it likely cannot sustain water on its surface right now. But what means is that the parent body of Bennu, because typically all these very small asteroids actually originated from a much bigger body that was disrupted at some point, breaking it up into smaller chunks. And so what it means is that Bennu's parent body likely had water at its surface. And that definitely tells us something about how water was distributed across the solar system in the very early stages of the solar system. And then, yes, by looking at the isotopes and looking at the geochemistry of the sample when it's returned, that will be able to tell us about if it helped bring life to Earth.
So when will the spacecraft be bringing the sample back, and what is left for the kind of future of the mission? How long will the mission be going on, and what sort of science can we expect?
Yeah, so we actually have quite a lot of time left in the mission. And so we're currently in a phase where the spacecraft is doing flybys of the poles as well as the equator to really understand the mass of the body and understand its shape really well. And that's needed so that the spacecraft can go into orbit safely about the asteroid. So while we're at Bennu, we haven't really gone into orbit yet, but we're supposed to go into orbit on New Year's Eve. So just, you know, in a few days' time, actually. And then once we go into orbit, we'll start doing the mapping, the compositional mapping. And that part of the mission will go on for quite some time, because we're not actually going to sample the surface until July 2020. And so from now until July 2020, we'll really be understanding the surface composition and physical properties and where we see fine materials that we can sample. And then once we get global maps, we'll then down select that to a select number of sampling sites. And then at one point, the spacecraft will start doing practices where it will actually go down to the surface, act like it's going to sample the surface, but not. And it'll have a lot of opportunity to do those tests to make sure that when we are ready to sample in July 2020, we really know what we're doing. And then the sample actually doesn't start making its way back to Earth until March of 2021. And it'll take about 2 years to get back to Earth. And so the sample is supposed to arrive on Earth September of 2023. So we still have a little ways to go before we actually get the sample back here on Earth.
Well, it seems like a very exciting mission, and certainly one to keep an eye on in 2019 and indeed over the next few years. But yeah, I just wanted to say thanks for speaking to me today, and good luck with all your future asteroid endeavors.
Thank you very much.
That was Kerry Donaldson-Hanna talking about the OSIRIS-REx mission. To find out more about the space missions coming up in 2019, don't forget to pick up the January issue of BBC Sky Night magazine. There's lots to see in the night sky in January, and you can find out more about how to see it all in this month's issue. For me, however, there is one standout event this month, and that's the lunar eclipse on the 21st of January. A lunar eclipse is a stunning and easy-to-view event that astronomers of any level can enjoy, and as long as the skies are clear, it should be visible right across the UK. January's will require an early start, as it takes place roughly between 3:30 and 6:50 UT in the morning of the 21st. With totality falling between 4:41 and 5:43. The moon will be in the southwest at that time, so make sure your observing site has a clear view in that direction. Then all you need to do is get up in time and watch as the moon gradually fades from white to grey to red and then back again. You can find out more about the lunar eclipse in the January issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, as well as discovering how NASA is using artificial intelligence to explore space, how to take scientifically useful images of the inner and outer planets, and read our interview with the head of New Horizons, Alan Stern. And not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.